Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy, high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Greg Pence. Greg Pence is a professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama, author of Designer Food, Mutant Harvest, or Breadbasket of the World, and also Who's Afraid of Human Cloning? Welcome, Greg.
Welcome, and I'm at the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
At Birmingham, okay. And how did you come to turn your attention from traditional bioethics concerns, when to pull the plug on grandma, and your concern over cloning, which you've been writing about, to genetically modified foods with this most recent book?
One way to think about my book on cloning is it exposes stupid things people think about human cloning, and it was a natural segue into stupid things people think about genetically modified plants. And medical ethics sometimes gets constraining, and to me, bioethics is much broader, and so it includes topics about the origin of life and death that aren't medical, and that's where genetically modified food comes in, where the food might not only help starving people, but eradicate diseases caused by starving, and even carry vaccines.
You start your book off with a discussion of the safety of organic foods, which right off the bat, you're throwing down a gauntlet by talking to most people's concerns about, you know, eating healthy food, and you're saying that there are actual risks of organic foods.
Well, this was news to me. In researching the book, I'd always assumed that organic foods were much safer. I have a sister who basically eats only organic foods, and I was really shocked to find that people had died of organic foods, especially E. coli. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that we make a lot of assumptions about what's safe and what's unsafe, and in context, GM veggies seem really safe.
E. coli is a bacteria that lies on organic vegetables because of the use of manure?
Yes, it's very easy to get contaminated, and especially if the vegetables aren't washed correctly. And it's kind of a hidden stealth story out there just how dangerous it is.
The risks, the risk assessment from the pesticides and the fertilizers that also lie on non-organic vegetables, that's pretty difficult assessment to do.
The same BT that is the source of all the concern about Starling corn and genetically modified corn, and which is also called BT corn when it's genetically modified, that's the same pesticide that you can spray on an organic food. So it's just a matter of degree whether you put the gene for it inside the food or spray it on.
And it's not harmful to humans, that particular pesticide?
No. That's why it's allowed on organic food. I mean, it's probably the EPA considers it the safest pesticide.
Yeah. Now, what are the actual dangers of genetically modified food? We hear about them possibly harming butterflies. We hear about them spreading, you know, beyond their bounds and encroaching on other environments. But are there any actual documented dangers to human beings from genetic modified foods that we know of yet?
The only thing that might possibly be true is some proteins that are created might be a little bit harder to digest and might cause, like, stomach acid. But that's, and that's even not proven, just kind of speculation. And it's also true that things that are now considered pretty safe, like, that there's a lot of foods that we eat that are imported from other countries that really aren't tested very much. So I think probably there's a very high bar been put on genetically modified veggies, which is what they pass. They've probably been more tested than any food that's ever been introduced. But there's also a lot of hysteria. As soon as you mention the word genetic, it sounds like you're tampering with something very essential.
In the latest issue of Harper's Magazine, Barry Commoner has an article. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it yet.
Read an abstract of it.
Yeah. His basic argument is one that's been kicking around for a while, but he gives it a full dose there, that the genome and its workings that turn it into a phenotype are too complicated for us to possibly ever understand, and certainly more complicated than taking snippets of one and putting in another and making transgenic things that work well. What do you think about that argument? Is that just a restatement of the warning against hubris? Is that part of this mysticism, or are there actual scientific arguments out there for why GM foods might behave in ways that we can't predict?
Well, I mean, I think they're tools, and it's like a hammer. A hammer can be used to build a house or bash in someone's brains, and it would be wrong to say that if someone wanted to do something wrong with a hammer or even a dialysis machine, you couldn't do harm with it. But that doesn't mean that you don't create the tools. Although I guess there are Luddites in the world who would have us not create any tool that might possibly be used by some nut for harm. I think Commoner is it's sad. I think he's become a scaremonger all of a sudden. And I think most people won't understand the issues and will listen to him and think there's some kind of great danger at genetically modified food. You know, there's an old history of scaring people about food. When this country was settled, no one would eat tomatoes because they were considered poisonous. And finally, a fairly famous New Yorker one day announced that he was going to eat about 100, and people gathered to watch him die.
I know people who still have that myth in their head.
Well,
now the Europeans, not to blame the old world for all of our myths and irrationality, but the Europeans seem to be particularly exercised about food concerns, and partly for justified reason. They've had this mad cow scare. But then they've turned it into some kind of horror at American genetically modified food and see it as emblematic of globalization in general, don't they?
Yes, and we're to blame for this in part. And if we were living in Britain right now, we would probably be very suspicious of our food system because their public health authorities did in fact lie to them. They were allowing their farmers to do something that was actually barbaric and atrocious. They were cows will eat almost anything, and when cows died, the farmers just regarded the carcass as wasted feed. So they were grinding up the dead cows and putting it into cattle feed to bulk up the cattle, and somewhere along the line, a virus in the family of what's called a spongiform encephalopathies, which also caused scrappy in sheep and Jakob-Creutzfeldt disease in humans, crossed over from sheep to cattle, and there was a baseline cow that got infected, and then its brains were fed to other cattle, and so on and so on. And then the virus mutated again such that humans who consumed it got this variant of CJD called mad cow disease. So England got really scared. A lot of 100 people died. And then right at that point, Monsanto did a self-introduction of GM foods in the same way that the cannibalism had been introduced to the British cattle industry, same kind of stealth secret. And so then the agricultural officials who had lied to the public before said, trust us about GM food. And of course, the public was not willing to buy that.
And in fact, we've had our own evidence over here that the laws that were passed to regulate the testing and safety of the food supply were circumvented, that GM corn got into the food supply before it was ready to be released.
Right. Although to me, that's not as big of an issue as we're just lucky because our cattle were always fed soybeans just because soybeans are just so plentiful and cheap in this country. If that hadn't been the case, we would have fed them dead cattle too. The scandal in our country is really about beef. Just the other night, CBS had an expose that said 500 people a year die of salmonella, a million get sick, and basically, when it says USDA certified on beef, that means absolutely nothing now because people can't even stop a rotting carcass on a beef assembly line.
The weakness of the American social welfare state.
Well,
we don't have a regulatory apparatus.
We really don't, because Phil Graham's wife was also involved with Enron, was the head of the regulatory agency that was supposed to regulate meat. They're both from Texas, a big beef-producing state. And basically she believed that she who regulates least regulates best. And so all these meat inspectors have quit. The argument of the book is, look, if you still eat meat, especially if you eat hamburger, you shouldn't be worried at all about GM veggies.
Yeah.
It's just like orders of magnitude safer to eat the genetically modified veggies than it is to eat a hamburger.
I'm talking with Greg Pence. He's the author of Designer Food, Mutant Harvest, or Breadbasket of the World, and he's a professor of philosophy at University of Alabama at Birmingham. Greg, I want to skip over Europe for a second. We'll come back to it and about globalization and all that. But there's been a debate going on for 30 years about whether the Green Revolution is necessary to feed the third world. The folks at Food First have been very influential in arguing that economic redistribution, land reform, and potentially vegetarianism, or at least a de-emphasis on meat, would permit everyone in the world to eat well on what we currently can grow, and that we wouldn't need these new strains. And that argument has bolstered the Luddite arguments against genetically modified food. Where do you come down? It seems like you come down on both sides, that you agree that those arguments, that there should be that kind of redistribution, and that that's partly right, but that the majority of the scientific consensus even if we had that kind of redistribution, even if we went that route, we would still need GM foods in order to feed everybody in the world.
Well, my view may be a little bit surprising. It turns out, I think the Green Revolution of the early 70s, which Norman Borlaug won a Nobel Prize for, really saved about a billion people, especially highly intensive chemical farming and pesticides. If we had to feed the world organically or not use beef, we would probably have to cut down most of the Amazon rainforest and convert millions of acres of pasture into farm fields, because it just takes a lot of land to grow that many vegetables and fruits. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I was very convinced in reading about starvation by Amartya Sen's work.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he won a Nobel Prize for this, and basically his work points out that all these desires to transfer something, whether it's food or wells or contraception, which is basically what many liberals view of how you solve starvation, that it won't work, according to him, because of property rights. Because when you get into the Sub-Sahara or in Ethiopia or Sudan, and you, even if you could get the food there, you've got to get it upriver, and somebody controls the rights to that river. You have to get it into the village, and someone controls the rights to distribute it, and so on and so on. And you can't really do any of that. And the point is not just a matter of power. It's Sen's point was that there are existing social structures and governments that give people rights over food, because food there is power and life. And you can't just go in and dump food on people without violating someone's property rights.
Mm.
So that makes it much more difficult to say you can just transfer something.
Mm.
So based on his work, I argue that the key is really to letting other countries develop self-sufficient food,
mm-hmm,
rather than transferring something.
And to do that, they probably, especially in the parts of the world that are more barren, they would need genetically modified foods.
Yes, although it is true that Greenpeace and some Indian intellectuals have opposed even what they call dumping GM corn on starving people. If we could actually get it to them and they could eat it, I don't think the starving people would matter one at all if the food was genetically modified.
There is no big third world protest against genetically modified food. It's just a couple third world intellectuals, right?
Yes, but people like Vandana Shiva are very influential.
Yeah.
She has a view of India where I guess there would be maternal food co-ops that would be used recycled dung, and everyone would be a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
She thinks that's a pro-woman view. I don't.
Right.
I don't think any woman wants to spend all her day raising food.
You articulate four positions in the debate over GM foods: the naturalists, progressives, egalitarians, and globalists. Can you give us a thumbnail for what you mean by each of those?
A naturalist is very tied to the land and believes in sort of the absolute value of the environment. An egalitarian is more concerned with creating a just distribution of resources around the world, even at the expense of personal liberty. A globalist believes in a market that will maybe have a country such as Ecuador producing all the shrimp for the world, or a country such as Colombia producing all the coffee. And a scientific progressive just believes in the tools of science.
Mm-hmm. And you articulate that you think that all of these progressives have something to contribute, perhaps the naturalists a little bit less, but the progressives, egalitarians, and globalists a little bit more.
Well, I think we get intuitions from all those worldviews.
Mm-hmm.
And, if we're hiking on a and the Tetons on vacation were probably more sympathetic to the naturalist point of view. But we may not be willing to pay five times as much for naturalist food when we actually go to the grocery store.
Now, the naturalists and the egalitarians have wielded a new principle in international scientific policy called the precautionary principle. Tell us, I mean, is this just basically a stalking horse for Luddism? It says we can't know everything about the consequences of our actions, so we shouldn't do anything?
Sometimes it seems like it is such a stalking horse. It's really a difference in onus of proof. I don't see how you can ever prove something completely safe. And so you could never really satisfy a strong version of the precautionary principle. There are weaker versions, and our country is certainly, the United States and Canada are certainly pushing for a weaker version. I also think the precautionary principle in Europe really is a kind of mask for protectionism. They really are afraid of not only our efficiency in producing corn and soybeans, but also what they see is the American attitude to food. You know, McCafes and every block playing rap music. And they really are afraid of that.
They associate American globalization, American global culture, with the degradation of the quality of their own food.
Yes, they've already suffered the fact that our movies, our music, even our TV shows have trumped their own, especially with their youth, and certainly our computers. And so food would be the last insult. And indeed, if you go to Europe, you know, even I was in China 10 years ago, and I was shocked to see a Kentucky Fried Chicken right there in front of the Imperial Palace.
Rocky, you also talk about radical naturalists. We want to get to this, definitely. The deep ecologists. I used to edit a publication called Eco-Socialist Review, which the deep ecologists were our bete noire within the radical left gambit there. And so I, of course, welcomed your strident critique of deep ecological influence in environmental movement. And this week, I was horrified to see that Greenpeace had joined the campaign against therapeutic cloning, much to the surprise of other environmental organizations who don't see that within their ambit. But isn't this a continuation of what you describe as the valuing of some kind of abstract nature over actual existing human beings?
Yes, and Greenpeace, this is a real wake-up call to me. Greenpeace has looked for flashy issues to build its prominence on and to collect funds around. And I'm sort of had a conversion experience because I consider myself an environmentalist. I was an Eagle Scout and did a lot of camping. But I guess you just have to stop and think critically. Something like 78% of Americans agree with the statement that we should do almost everything to protect the environment. I think people haven't really thought about what that means because there are competing interests. And certainly, I'm afraid that Greenpeace has not really told the whole truth about the dangers of genetically modified food, but it's certainly been a very effective tool for them to raise money around. And they've really adopted some scare campaigns. Going against therapeutic embryo cloning is a shocker.
You also talk about the history of ecological concerns on the far right. And in fact, in Europe, far right parties and groups have attempted to clothe themselves in Green Party rhetoric. Most Green parties are left wing, but there's a kind of convergence at the other end when you have folks who say, we want to protect Mother Earth, and therefore we think AIDS is a good thing for Mother Earth because it's killing human beings. Isn't that the kind of eco-fascism that you're talking about?
Yes, and I was amazed to realize the similarity of some of the statements that people are making now with some of the statements that were made in the Third Reich. Wendell Berry, who's a very famous poet and essayist from Kentucky, writes that the land has an absolute value and that nothing ever justifies messing with the land or destroying it. That's very, very close to the Third Reich's worship of the native soil and the purity of the soil of the fatherland. And many of Hitler's generals, including Hitler himself, were vegetarians, and they were certainly pushing organic farming. And this whole idea of the purity of the people, the purity of the land, the purity of the environment, is a very dangerous idea if you don't take it in some kind of context. If you just put it out there, and especially if passionate young people pick it up, it can be a kind of scary thing.
The flip side of that is really the Enlightenment tradition, in my view, that human beings have the only ethical justification for any kind of normative assertion is human interests, and that human beings, it's in their interests to take control of our own destiny and to manage the world around us. And it's those who posit some kind of natural order, God or Allah or nature, who are trying to tell us, no, you're not allowed to manage your own affairs.
Well, I mean, I'm an unapologetic anthropomorphic secular humanist.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say you're right on the right, but there's also a pincer movement, because there's also much more radical people who believe that humans are just, you know, one interest among many millions of others in the ecosystem. So we have to take account the interest of other mammals and crabs and ants and locusts. And I think that's nuts. But both the right and the left there are kind of coming in a pincer movement against genetically modified plants, and also against, in regular medical ethics, against parental choice over future traits of children.
You're, in the conclusions of your book, you talk about a number of different policy upshots of the debate. One that I was particularly intrigued by, and I discussed with Peter Singer when he was on this show, was the ethical problems of, you said in your book that you don't eat pigs because you're concerned about the intelligence of pigs, and I agree with that general proposition that the intelligence of a thing should be a guide to how much ethical weight it has in our lives. But then you talk about the prospect of engineering intelligence out of farm animals, out of meat animals, and whether that would make agriculture for meat more palatable. You think that is something you would like to do?
Well, I think I have different intuitions. I mean, certainly as far as I'm a utilitarian, think pain counts. Having less pain in the world is a good thing. There is something in me that's a naturalist that says aesthetically this doesn't seem to be a wonderful thing to do. I would rather people not do that, but as long as people are going to eat meat, it would certainly be better for them, the animals, not to suffer. I must say that the main reason I don't eat meat now is not just a moral reason. After studying it, I just can't bring myself to do it anymore.
So you're a vegetarian completely?
Yes, but mainly from what Aristotle would say, I just lost my ability to appreciate it and actually have the opposite reaction. It's kind of like when I started out in medical ethics, I did rounds for 6 months in the cancer ward, and I was smoking before I started, but I just could not smoke and do those rounds. So by doing a rather intensive investigation of the meat industry in this country, I have these very powerful images in my mind that just completely makes me not want to eat meat.
Hmm.
I actually have gotten sick a couple of times when I tried to eat it lately.
Hmm. A little knowledge can be a bad thing, I guess, sometimes.
It can change your feelings,
yes.
As Aristotle would say, or educate them.
You've also talked in the book about labeling, and this is one place where I do want to pick a bone with you because, for instance, I'm allergic to gluten, and I have to examine every food label that comes across my plate very carefully to make sure that it doesn't have any wheat, oats, buckwheat, barley, rye products in them. And the prospect of rampant recombination of foods I welcome as long as I am sure that that recombination is not endangered, you know, put potential allergens in my path. And my allergy isn't even anaphylactic. Those who have anaphylactic reactions
sure.
would have even harder problems. So that's one kind of concern. But don't we generally have a right as consumers to know what's in our food?
Well, I think we have anything that might harm us like that, I think we do have a right to know. It's just, if you put the label, if you just say this has been genetically modified, I think that's so scary. And there are lots of things like a changelo that have been created, or super broccoli, where thousands of genes have mixed and creating the hybrid, which may in fact be far more dangerous to people. So I think on the one hand, you're giving people a false assurance about non-genetically modified food, and you're probably artificially scaring them if you put the GMO label on food. But I do think that anything that might create a known allergen should be labeled. That's a slightly different issue. I don't think anyone in the food industry really is against labeling stuff that has known allergens.
So what you're opposed to is kind of a Surgeon General's warning, the warning this has is genetically modified food. That wouldn't be helpful, but
right, because it doesn't mean anything.
Right. Okay. The final point I want to talk about your book, which I think is also another strain here in the naturalist critique. You mentioned Wendell Berry. The defense of the family farm. I am an old-style urbanist Marxist on this. When Marx said that the value of the capitalist revolution is that it frees people from the idiocy of rural life, you know, I give a good cheer. Now I find myself trapped here in rural eastern Connecticut, so I don't know what to do about that. But you're talking in the book about the family farm. It seems to me that the economies of scale and the ability of quality control on in agribusiness, that those who would be concerned about quality of food would want there to be a larger scale production of food because it would be easier to monitor, easier to assure that that the right things are being done to food if you had it on that bigger scale. Do you think that that makes some sense? Or is it, you know, this whole romanticization that small family farmers who are pressed to the bone economically are all going around stockpiling manure and old leaves in order to do organic things, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it's not. You can't make a living doing that. And it's just really hard work, a lot of marriages. We have a very strange farm policy in this country, and the bill is up before Congress right now. I was shocked to learn that we spend $28 billion a year on farm welfare, and about half of that...
As does almost every industrialized country.
Yeah. No, I mean, Europe spends more. But still, about half of that goes to 8% of the farms, who are wealthy Republicans, basically paid not to grow things, and who probably tend to listen to Rush Limbaugh and be anti-government. But they're they're profiting very handsomely, and no one will touch doing away of farm subsidies, because in our public consciousness, Willie Nelson and John Cougar Mellencamp have created these images of the family farm, and they're tied to these subsidies. And so they aren't really saving the family farm. They're saving rich Republicans involved in agribusiness. But that's our farm policy. And as Wendell Berry has said, even despite all these subsidies since 1945, millions and millions of people have left the farm, and they still are doing it. Most small towns are not places where anybody wants to live, and it looks to be kind of inevitable that this will continue.
Yeah, I say let the robots do it.
There's a different question about, it's an aesthetic question about public policy, which intrigues me, and that is the question, there's actually two parts of this question. One is, how much wildness do we want to preserve in our country? And secondly, how much farming do we want to preserve, just in terms of driving through the countryside? And I think European countries have decided that they want to preserve a lot of both and are willing to subsidize it just for aesthetic reasons and reasons of tourism. And that might be okay.
Well, it might, but it costs us all a lot of money.
It does, but we you know, it would be better to me if we were honest about it, mm-hmm, rather than saying we're all saving the farmer's family farm.
Yeah. I think you've written a great book. I've been talking to Greg Pence. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He's the author of Designer Food, Mutant Harvest, or Breadbasket of the World, which will hit the bookshelves in March. It's available through Amazon now.
Uh-huh.
Good. And he's also written Who's Afraid of Human Cloning, which is another great book, and argues the same similar sets of points about the public hysteria about cloning. Greg, we're obviously going to have you back to talk again, but I want to thank you for this.
Well, thank you, Jay. And if you don't want a single author book, there's a companion anthology to the book called Ethics of Food, where I let the different writers speak for themselves.
Excellent. Okay, talk to you later.
Okay, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.